Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and it's a new year, and in case you haven't realized it, if you go to the bookstores are piled high with diet books. And if you read popular newspapers, magazines, or watch TV, the media is replete with reviews of various diets. They're talking paleo, they're talking vegan, they're talking Atkins, they're talking gluten-free. But today we're going to talk about a diet that is beginning to make waves, and it's not our intent to come up with some gimmicky way for you to lose that extra 5 or 8 pounds that you gained over the holidays. We're talking about an approach to weight optimization, but also health optimization. We're going to talk to an expert. He is a neuroscientist. He's at the National Institute of Aging, and he's considered one of the world's scientific experts on the subject of intermittent fasting, IF for short. IF is the basis for some new popular diet books that emphasize what is sometimes referred to as the 5-2 plan, which means that you get to eat what you want 5 days, but for 2 days you fast or you limit your food intake. And we're going to take a look at the scientific bona fides of this. Dr. Mart Mattson is a senior investigator and chief of the Laboratory of Neurosciences at the National Institute on Aging. And he is an expert on the relationship between diet and various types of physiological outcomes. So welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast, Dr. Mattson.
It's nice to be with you today, Ron.
Well, first of all, give us a definition of this. I mean, this is what does this entail? What is intermittent fasting?
Yeah, well, one working definition is going periods of time of 16 to 24 hours without food or with very little food, say 2 or 3 days a week. And the reason that seems to be have, as we'll talk about in our conversation, some profound effects on health indicators is that if you don't eat for 12 to 16 hours, you shift from using energy in your liver to burning fat. And if you eat 3 meals a day spaced apart, every time you eat, the energy goes to your liver. It's stored in glycogen, and that's tapped into before you ever burn fat. So actually, if you eat 3 meals a day, you're probably not burning much fat at all.
Well, you know, this seems to violate one of the basic tenets of dieting, which is, and you know, if you look at TV these days, they're having all these specials. Like, for example, on the Today Show, they'll have a young nutritionist named Stacy or Heather talking about how important it is if you're quote dieting or trying to lose weight to make sure that you never go hungry, that you always have snacks. Make sure you have like a few nuts handy, that you don't go too many hours without eating, because if you start feeling real hungry, that'll defeat your whole diet resolve and game over.
It's certainly true that if you overeat, you're going to not lose weight, no matter how you divide your meals up. But turns out, whenever you eat, that actually stimulates hunger, particularly if you're eating carbs. Mm-hmm. And so if you go without food for 12 to 16 hours, if you can get by that first little hunger bout, that's because you've been regularly eating 3 meals a day. You get used to eating 3 meals a day. Then when it's time to eat a meal, you're hungry. But it turns out if you go for, say, 16 hours and you shift to burning fats, you're actually, your hunger is suppressed a little bit.
You're saying where you sort of get off the insulin merry-go-round in some ways.
Yeah, that's right. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the animal work first.
Okay.
Where we can control the diet. They don't have any choice on the diet. And in animals, if we compare animals that eat as much as they want whenever they want to animals that have been on an alternate day fasting diet, the animals on the alternate day fasting diet, which is every other day they have no food for 24 hours. If we start that when they're young, they'll live 30% longer. And we found that it has, the alternate day fasting has profound effects in improving glucose regulation. The animals have very low insulin levels. Their blood pressure is maintained lower. Their resting heart rate is lower. And I'm a neuroscientist, so we've done a lot of work looking at the brain, and their brain functions better, and their nerve cells are more resistant to stress.
And that's what's sometimes referred to as CR, caloric restriction.
Now, this is the alternate day fasting.
Oh, the alternate day fasting. Okay.
Yep. And So in the alternate day fasting, the animals, essentially what you do is one day you go in and you remove their food. Then the next day you go in the same time, give them food back, next day remove it. So every other day they have no food for 24 hours. So that's very similar to what I'm talking about what's now starting to develop in some initial human studies we did and kind of in the popular press with the 5-2 diet. And that is that, so we did all this work in animals and we wanted to know, first, can humans comply with this kind of diet, which seems kind of harsh? Mm-hmm. And so that's number one. Number two, if they can, what effects does it have on their health? So we've published three studies so far in humans. The first one, and they're all in overweight people. The first study was in asthma patients. And we put them on a diet where every other day they only ate 500 calories. And so,
give us an idea what 500 calories might look like, because a lot of people can't visualize what can you eat when you're given a 500 calorie diet.
Well, you can have a big plate of vegetables with some nuts and maybe a piece of fish, or you could have an apple, yogurt, and maybe a bagel. So something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that in the asthma.
So that's usually one meal, one meal per day. Okay.
Yeah. So in the asthma patients, we had them on the diet for 2 months. The only subject that dropped out in the first 2 weeks, and we found this in other studies too, that if you can kind of get through the big transition from your normal eating pattern to intermittent fasting, it can be not so hard to do as you might think. But then, and so in that study, we found their asthma symptoms improved. Of course, they lost weight. Their airway resistance improved, and markers of inflammation and oxidative stress were reduced. But then we went to another study in collaboration with Dr. Harvey, Michelle Harvey at University of Manchester in the UK, who works with women at risk for breast cancer because of their family history and their weight. And in that study, we had over 100 women. We divided them into three diet groups. One group we told, don't change your diet. The second group, we had them eat three meals a day, but we reduced the calories in each meal by 25%. So they had a counting calorie type diet. Then the third group, we had them 2 days a week eat only 500 calories. The other 5 days, they were told to eat normally as they usually do.
Uh-huh.
And it was a 6-month study. And what we found in this study was that, as you might imagine, both the calorie counting diet group and the intermittent fasting group, both group of women lost weight. However, the women on the what's now called the 5-2 diet, which that's based on the study I'm talking about, those women lost more belly fat and their insulin sensitivity increased significantly more than the women on the eating three meals but reducing calorie intake.
So I think what you're suggesting is that it's not just a matter of on those days you have a little bit of a calorie deficit, and over the course of a week or a month, you know, there's such and so many less calories. It's not just a calorie reduction thing. It's something about how you rejigger the body when you go from normal eating to some degree of caloric deprivation for just a short period of time.
Yeah, that's right. And in addition to what I mentioned about shifting the energy utilization from the liver to burning fat, what we found in our animal studies where we can take out tissues, and we focus on the brain, so we do a lot of studies of the brain, but we can take out other tissues, heart, for example, muscle. We think, or have very strong evidence for in animals, that the intermittent fasting is a challenge or a mild stress to not only to the whole animal, but also to the individual cells and all the tissues. So it's kind of similar to exercise. Vigorous mm-hmm. exercise, it's an energetic challenge. It imposes stress on cells, obviously on muscle cells. During the exercise, there's increased free radical production, increased energy demand. So the cells are under stress during the exercise. But having had gone through that stress, the cells bolster their ability to cope with stress. So we find that with intermittent fasting, that cells are increasing, for example, levels of proteins and enzymes that help them resist stress, and we think may protect them against disease.
Like glutathione, for example, things like that.
Yep, antioxidants. We've looked at some antioxidants like heme oxygenase. Also, proteins that are called protein chaperones that prevent the accumulation of damaged molecules. We've found recently we have evidence in the animal studies that that the intermittent fasting increases production in the brain of proteins that are called neurotrophic factors that promote the growth and survival of neurons. And we also have a
like BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor that makes your neurons repair and replicate.
Exactly, and that's one. That's exactly one that we focused on a lot, because there's a lot of evidence that BDNF plays important roles in learning and memory. Mm-hmm. That it others had previously shown that exercise in animals, and there's some evidence from humans too, will increase BDNF levels, and that may enhance or optimize cognitive function, learning and memory. And if you think about it, Ron, from the standpoint of evolution, if an animal and our human ancestors are in a situation where they don't have a refrigerator and can't eat food continuously, can't eat three meals a day, and have to go extended time periods without food, if you haven't eaten for a while, you better figure out how to find food. And so what we're finding in the animal studies is that the intermittent fasting, essentially it improves the cognitive function of the animals, and we have some insight into why that is. BDNF is part of this story, but there's more to it. So during evolution, individuals that were able to have optimum or to optimize their brain function under conditions where they haven't eaten for a while are clearly going to have a survival advantage. So we think that the challenge of going without food is a stimulus to our, I'm talking about the brain, but also it turns out it's a challenge to our energy regulating system in general.
So if, you know, another way of saying this is what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. It increases your resilience by sort of training your system to get through periods of deprivation.
Yeah, that's right. One finding we had is very striking is we measured blood pressure and heart rate in rats and mice continuously as we transitioned them from their normal ad libitum diet to eating intermittent fasting diet. And What we found is there's a very dramatic reduction in blood pressure and resting heart rate that occurs over a period of several weeks that in magnitude is as much as is seen in animals that we put running wheels in their cage and get a lot of exercise. So, again, there's this kind of very interesting changes that are seen with intermittent fasting that are similar to what's seen in trained endurance athletes, although certainly there are some differences, but in a general sense, we're seeing a lot of the same changes with intermittent fasting that are seen with exercise training.
Wow, that is exciting. But in a way, this is true paleo diet, because if we talk about the paleo diet, we say, well, you know, our ancestors ate a lot of meat, we didn't eat grains, all those considerations. But another consideration was also the temporal frequency of the feedings, and life was unpredictable in Paleolithic times and among modern less industrialized populations, where food is, humans are opportunistic. They obtain food when it's available, and when it's not, there are periods of relative deprivation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So our evolutionary history and therefore our genes, which don't change real rapidly, they're more geared for intermittent fasting than for three meals a day plus snacks. It's only recently in our history that we've been eating three meals a day plus snacks, and clearly, at least in this country, three meals a day plus snacks, there's a lot of people that are overweight with that kind of a scenario.
So maybe this is just not necessarily a physiologic requirement that you eat all the time, but more of a cultural adaptation, is that, you know, we sort of take a break, we congregate, we socialize, we structure our day around our meals, but that this isn't necessarily the way that nature intended.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, and one extension of that is that one interesting thing is that in the human studies we've done, it's not really proof, but we did some things like mood questionnaires and gave the subjects some questionnaires on various aspects of how they're feeling when they're in the diet and so on. And what we found is that during the first couple weeks, as they transition from normally eating three meals a day plus snacks to doing, say, the 5-2 diet, that there was a change. And on the days that they were eating only 500 calories, they felt a little grumpy and a little irritable, and very likely in part because the neurons in their brain are more active. But then after about 3 weeks and by a month, for sure, they started reporting that their mood was improving and they were feeling better. One thing, too, that, and this is anecdotal, but it's kind of interesting and it makes a lot of sense. For example, if you eat three meals a day, oftentimes after you eat a meal, you feel a little sleepy.
Yep.
And so, in general, the people are reporting that on the days that they're only eating one meal, they feel less sleepy and more alert. And so there's, you know, a lot of work that needs to be done, but there's the possibility that this kind of diet could also even improve productivity or, keeping your mind sharp. I went to a meeting a couple of years ago that was organized by the Air Force and NASA. And it was a very small meeting with only about a dozen people. And what they're interested in is a lot of the military nowadays, it's very critical that they be able to keep their minds alert for extended time periods.
Right.
You know, for example, like you're flying a drone or something for 24 hours. And, you know, and so they were interested, and I don't know if they're going to pursue or not, but they were interested in the idea, well, can they get the military people or astronauts accustomed to an intermittent fasting type diet, and then so that when they're in the critical periods where they have to keep their mind sharp, for extended time period that they can just not eat during that time period, and then won't get the postprandial sleepiness.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you report on this because, you know, before I knew about this, before I had contact with you, before I read your articles, I coined a phrase, and I wrote about it in a blog, which is, the phrase is, hunger is my friend. And I suggested to people that they not interpret their hunger signals as signals of distress, that hunger may actually be a helpful physiologic process. And if you can do a little cognitive reframing and say, gee, during the time in which I'm hungry, I'm going into fat-burning metabolism, and my body is becoming stronger and more resilient, and you know, losing weight is one of the added dividends of that. And it turns out that indeed a period of relative deprivation or hunger followed by cessation of hunger, because you get used to it, can indeed be your friend.
Yeah, we think so. It's clearly in the animals, it's their friend, because we can get them to live 30% longer, which is a huge increase in their lifespan, and they have fewer cancers. And we study models of neurodegenerative disorders, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease. And in our animal models, the intermittent fasting can counteract the changes in the brain that are occurring and that lead to cognitive impairment in the Alzheimer's model, or degeneration of dopamine neurons in the Parkinson's model. So, being hungry to a point is good. But to maintain optimal health, another thing about intermittent fasting is in all our animal studies, nutrition is maintained. So on the days the animals eat food, they're eating a nutritious diet that has vitamins and minerals and everything. And applying that to humans, if, say, for 2 days a week, on those 2 days you eat only one meal, as long as the other 5 days you eat a healthy diet, mm-hmm. There's no problem, we think, in becoming malnourished.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that would be a concern, because some people have marginal nutrition. They eat junk food, and then they would, you know, further compromise their nutrition by eating less on certain days. It's important to have a good diet on the days that you eat.
That's very critical. Everyone should be encouraged to eat a lot of vegetables, fruits, nuts, fish, whole grains, although there's some controversy coming on grains, but whole grains generally seem to be good. And, the idea the take-home message should be not that if I don't eat much on 2 days a week, I can eat whatever I want and mm-hmm. as much as I want the other five
right.
days. That's not the message. The message is to maintain a healthy diet, and a couple days a week, cut way back on the amount of food intake to cause these physiological changes that stimulate your cells to, we think, and the animals have data, protect them from developing disease, particularly in the context of aging.
Right. Now, so the concern is, and, you know, I think you probably have studied this in animals, and now you're beginning to study this in humans, is there's a tendency for people's caloric intake to equilibrate over time. So, you know, an example of which was when I was a young lad, I went fishing with a bunch of friends. There were five of us, and we went up into the mountains with our fishing rods and a few bags of trail mix. And over about 5 days, we ultimately didn't catch many fish, and we consumed the trail mix, and we were pretty darn hungry when we descended from the Sierra Mountains into the Central Valley of California. The first thing we came across on the highway was a big smorgasbord place, all you can eat. And I'll tell you, after we got finished with that place, they probably weren't too happy with the fact that they had, well, in those days, I think it was like a $3.99 all you can eat, because we practically cleaned out that place. Is it not the case that if you fast on or eat a few calories on one day, that you know, correspondingly you'll just make it up on the other day? Or do you find that animals and humans have the capacity to moderate their intake, even if they reduce their calories one day?
Yeah, in the animal studies, So we do the alternate day fasting. The animals do not eat twice as much food on the day they have food as they normally would. So it depends on the strain of rat or mouse, but they have an overall reduction in calorie intake of anywhere from 10 up to 25 or 30%. At least in that scenario where one day the animal has no food, on the next day it's not going to eat twice as much food to make up for that lost day of food. It will eat about 1.5 times as much or something like that. And then in the human studies, much more needs to be done. There's very little done long term. One issue that's completely unknown is, you know, can people stay on this kind of diet long term, years and years? And however, in the study that Dr. Harvey did, and we collaborated with her on the 5-2 diet studies, it was a 6-month study, and the compliance was really good for 6 months anyway. There has to be some motivation. Any of these diets, there has to be some level of motivation to want to do it. But we think that from a psychological standpoint, at least for some people, if they're overweight and want to lose weight, that psychologically it might be easier to stick with a diet where they only have to really focus on what they're eating 2 days a week rather than 7 days a week.
Right. Here's another wrinkle to this. Some people advocate out-and-out fasting. They say that, you know, every spring or once a season or maybe even once a month you ought to do, a spring cleaning. Go on a prolonged juice fast or even, a water fast for several days at a time. Have you studied that proposition at all? Is that a good idea? They're actually people, they're true fasting proponents. There have been, I think, throughout the history of natural healing, as people saying, if you want to treat or cure a malady or tune your body up, just do a fast.
Yep, there's a long history in this. One very interesting historical perspective is that in 1911, so over 100 years ago, Upton Sinclair, who is an author that many of your listeners may be familiar with because he wrote the book called The Jungle, which exposed the problems in the meatpacking industry. But he also wrote a book called The Fasting Cure. And you can find the full text PDF of it online. It wasn't science, and there hasn't been a lot of good science done with long-term fasting, but what he did was he essentially interviewed 250 people who had some chronic ailment, you know, whether it's chronic constipation or arthritis or, you know, many different maladies, and he interviewed them, and all these subjects had gone on fasts of various lengths, but they were extended fasts, you know, a week, 2 weeks, some of them even longer. And based on his interviews with them, except in a very few cases, like I think half a dozen out of all the 250 subjects, their self-reported health improved. And he had a comment in there that sometimes I put up when I present talks after showing all the data from our animal studies and some of the initial data coming out of human studies, is that he commented that surely it cannot be that men of science and medicine can ignore for very long such profound effects of fasting. So.
Well, here it is 100 years later, and I think we have mostly ignored the potential benefits of fasting.
One thing, so being at the NIH, a lot of, we do in many cases, we focus on aspects of diet and health that other industries, for example, pharmaceutical industry or the private sector, doesn't really have an interest in because they can't make any money.
Right. There's not a lot of commercialization potential for this. And by the way, you know, full disclosure here, Dr. Mattson is not like the author of a new popular diet book, or is offering a special line of 5-2 meal replacements that can be delivered to your doorstep. That's not how it works.
No, I'm just here to report our findings from animal studies and human studies and tell you and the listeners what we're finding in those studies. But I did want to point out that there's not so much research done on this from some aspects because not only is there not much money, nobody's going to make money off it, but there's some disincentive for the food industry, for
example.
Yes,
right. Yeah.
The food industry would lose 20% if people ate 20% less.
Right.
So if you have
lobbyists from ConAgra lobbying Congress, they may say, well, why don't you defund that wasteful NIH research that's looking at food restriction? That doesn't sound like it's very productive.
No, I mean, there's angles companies can take on it, for example, appetite suppressants, but those drugs cannot do what nature has evolved to do over millions of years, and that is activate systems either through exercise or we think intermittent fasting that are very complex and have an integrated effect on health. And drugs generally target one little pathway or mechanism and often have side effects where, you know, as far as we can tell, certainly not in the animals, skipping meals and going a day with little or no food now and then has no adverse side effects that we can detect.
No, indeed. Okay, so here's something that might be worthy of some consideration. It's the law of unintended consequences. You know, we have a certain percentage of people out there in the American populace who have somewhat funky ideas about dieting. And these are people who are prone to eating disorders. They tend to get a little high on food deprivation. Is it not possible that by encouraging intermittent fasting that some of these people might go off the deep end and get a little too far down the pathway towards caloric deprivation?
Can't rule that out. And just like so anorexia is a problem, particularly in young women.
Yeah.
And it's classified as a psychiatric disorder, kind of like an obsessive compulsive problem. You know, we don't know the answer to your question whether intermittent fasting would make it worse or better for them. I mean, if on the days, if they did the diet, if they're restricting their food already every day, then obviously that's not a good thing to try to go on an intermittent fasting diet. So I think that's it's a special case where it's obviously clearly not recommended. At this point, overweight people, we know that if they, through, you know, whatever diet, can reduce their overall calorie intake and lose weight, that's going to benefit their health in the long run. And then the idea would be to try to maintain an optimum weight. And further work needs to be done, but intermittent fasting is one potential way that maybe some people can maintain that long term, and once they get down to ideal weight, that may help them maintain the weight.
How about people with inflammatory disorders, people who have, say, rheumatoid arthritis or osteoarthritis, or, you know, on blood tests show high levels of sedates or C-reactive protein? Do you think that this might be a potential therapeutic option for them?
Well, in our study of asthma patients, which is an inflammatory disorder, in that study, it definitely benefited the patients. And there is, I think there are some trials of intermittent fasting in patients with rheumatoid arthritis going on. I haven't seen any publications on that yet. But in the animals, intermittent fasting reduces inflammation. In human subjects, when we take the blood and measure levels of so-called pro-inflammatory cytokines like tumor necrosis factor and interleukin-1 beta, the intermittent fasting reduces those indicators of general inflammation. So the answer to your question is intermittent fasting can reduce inflammation in animal models, and it looks like that's true in humans too.
Well, that's very exciting. So it's not just about weight loss. It's not just about losing that 8 or 12 pounds that you need to lose before getting into that wedding dress. It's also about optimizing your inflammatory pathways, your brain neurotrophic factors, reducing cardiovascular risk, certainly reducing the risk for metabolic syndrome, diabetes, and maybe even extending life by perhaps it increases the size of telomeres.
We don't know that. That's a good question. There's a lot of interest in the ends of chromosomes, and because they shorten during aging, and but that hasn't, it's been studied a little bit with daily calorie restriction. To my knowledge, it hasn't been looked at with intermittent fasting. And most of the telomere work, the cells that are studied are the white blood cells, the lymphocytes. Telomeres do get shorter in cells, particularly cells that divide a lot, proliferate a lot during aging. But we don't know yet whether intermittent fasting has an impact on that.
So I'm curious, you know, you as a researcher, this is a major theme in your research, and you've written more than 400 original research articles, more than 200 review articles and commentaries, so you're busy with the science of this. Does this ever carry over into your own personal lifestyle? Have you undertaken intermittent fasting, or is this something that you do routinely?
What I can say about that is that I do essentially follow the science, and you know, so I exercise regularly, and limit my energy intake so that I maintain a healthy weight, and in part I do that through intermittent fasting type of regimen.
Okay. So, did you have lunch today?
No.
Okay. That sort of speaks to that issue. Most of us did, and, you know, maybe we're feeling a little bit of that postprandial sluggishness that you're not experiencing right now, so you're able to call up all the important facts. All right, well, where can people learn more about this? You know, there's some popular books out there. Do you think those books are dumbing things down, or do you think people can, there's knowledge to glean from that, or should people go directly to the science?
I think overall the books are fine. The key message, though, is don't get the idea that this diet is a diet where it's okay to, on the days that you can eat whatever you want, that you eat unhealthy food. Otherwise, people are welcome to read those books. There's actually a lot of literature, or some literature coming out from the scientific standpoint. I've written a number of review articles. There's another one we have coming out soon that I wrote with a colleague at USC, Walter Longo, who focuses a lot on cancer and the effects of intermittent fasting on that. And PubMed is a really good source the source of scientific information. So if people are going to go on the web and look at science, they should go to PubMed. Not all the articles are freely available in full text, but more and more of them are. The NIH is trying to get any publication that the research was done with government money to be freely available to everyone, and that's happening. It's accelerating, so, and people are welcome to send me an email, and I'll send them a few articles.
And how should they find you? They could just Google Mark Mattson,
yep.
Mattson.
And, yeah, I'm the first one that comes up.
So. You're the first one that comes up. Dr. Mattson is, of course, at the National Institutes of Health. It's actually the specifically the Institute on Aging.
Yeah.
National Institute on Aging, correct?
That's right.
And a professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University. So I want to thank you very much, Dr. Mattson, for spending some time with us and for shedding light on what I think is going to become an increasingly appealing diet option. And it makes sense, and it's right up there with concepts like the gluten-free diet, the paleo diet, the low-carb diet, the glycemic index. I think intermittent fasting is an important consideration when we look at the optimal human diet. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, thanks, Ron.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce. And so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via our convenient internet portal or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the Intelligent Medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine. And she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.